This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming again to Landmark Women. Firstly, I just wanted to thank everybody for their patience with our new bookings and payment system. A few teething problems, but I think after the next few events, it'll be running really smoothly. But what I would do is encourage you all to give me some feedback on how it's working for you. Jeanette's laughing. So that I can fix those problems and make it work for everyone. Secondly, Sandy Forbes, who usually drives us seamlessly through these days, is unfortunately very ill today. And so she's got the flu, and her husband sent me a very long letter yesterday describing how sick she was, so I believe it. And she sends her apologies to you and also to Katrina. Just wait for you guys. So today we are welcoming Katrina Jackson. She is the CEO for the nation's peak science and technology body, Science and Technology Australia. She has a 25-year background in politics at the senior level, in the federal and in government and in opposition, in tertiary education and in print and radio journalism. And most recently, she led the Communications and External Liaison Office at the Australian National University, and prior to that was a senior staff member for former Science and Research Minister, Senator Kim Carr.
Goodness me, that's a week out of date. That,
is it?
That's a piece of information, isn't it? How politics changes. Sorry, honey.
That's fine. So, obviously, an incredibly accomplished woman, as our Landmark women always are, and I would like you to welcome her here today. Thank you.
I'll stand behind this for the very start while I'm talking to you just directly, but then I'm going to come down here and sit in the chair and get a bit closer because I feel terribly far away from you. Thank you very much for the introduction, and that's a straight read off my CV for my last job application. I sound a terrible stiff in that piece of paper, I must say. I always find writing CVs and effectively what is sort of a pitch for yourself a profoundly uncomfortable task. I know it's something we have to do. I know it's something women particularly have to work hard at, but it's not something I find particularly comfortable, I must say. So having it read back at you is quite an odd experience. I want to say thank you very much to Sandy for the invitation to come and speak with you today. I've known Sandy for a number of years, and we were journalistic colleagues back at the Canberra Times close to 20 years ago. I must say, after she asked and I accepted, I put the phone down and thought, goodness me, why on earth would she want me to do this? Why didn't she invite my mother, Maureen Fraser, who founded a magazine in Melbourne, is chair of virtually every literary festival in Melbourne, and a magnificently articulate woman. Why didn't she ask my aunt, Liz Jackson, who's got 7 Walkley Awards, who's made some of the best Four Corners programs in the country, who's genuinely changed people's lives? I made the mistake of voicing this hesitation in front of my mother while she was here for a weekend, and she gave me that look you only get from your mum when you're quite young, that don't you dare. And she had one sentence. She said, no man would ever ask that question, Katrina. You are an extraordinarily interesting woman. You've done a million interesting things. Don't you dare. Don't you dare doubt for a second that. Anyway, so blah, blah, blah. So there's the admission of a moment of surprise when the invitation came, but enormously pleased to have it. I looked down the list of people who have spoken to you before, and it's a magnificent and various list. This is obviously a really terrific and flourishing friends group. I understand you have a Rear Admiral very recently, and then you had the woman who's possibly the best maker of macarons in the country. What a magnificent contribution to society that is. And let's say, nice to have a woman doing it better than who is that Zumbo person who's all over the television? Some boy who's obviously copied her recipe. One of the very first things I did in university was I always wanted to be a journalist. I had an aunt who was a very good journalist. I had a sort of journalist-y sort of background. My background is effectively philosophers in academia and journalists and writers on the other side. So I, entirely true to type, did philosophy at university, and my ambition was to be a journalist. I'm afraid I haven't broken the mould at any point. One of the things I found fascinating from the start, however, which is a little bit different from perhaps some of the people you might have had before, is I've always found food and food culture and food writing absolutely fascinating. So I've done it in some form all throughout the various bits of my career. When I became the editor of a student newspaper at my university, back then at La Trobe University in Melbourne, one of the very first things I did was introduce a food column. There had apparently never been a food column ever in a student paper, and I got absolutely pilloried by all of the serious student politicians who thought this was seriously not fodder for a journal of record like Rabelais, the La Trobe University student newspaper. We got more correspondence and more food feedback from that food column than we did on anything else. The president of the SRC couldn't believe it. His long-winded 500-word rant every time on the front page, because he insisted and he funded it, never got any letters. The food column flooded with letters. One of the things I did when I first... my first job in Melbourne was working for a mob of Jesuits who were relatively closely linked to Jack Waterford, who was then the editor of the Canberra Times, or just had just become the editor of the Canberra Times. I worked for them straight out of university to earn some money, to be completely honest, and worked in community radio because that was the way to get in those days to journalism. I think if you listen to AM or PM or virtually any part of the ABC these days, virtually every single voice you hear is a voice that started either in community radio in Melbourne or in Sydney, in some cases here in Canberra at Triple X. So that was my first sort of gambit out into the world of journalism. You don't get paid, but it was extraordinarily exciting. And one of the people I got to be a regular contributor to the program was Jack Waterford. So Jack was our political correspondent. So every Thursday morning at... my show ran from 5:30 in the morning until 9:00. When you're new, you get the worst shift. We had the afternoon later as a reward for doing okay. Jack used to do the early shift for me, and finding Jack that time in the morning was a considerable challenge. I got to know his wife very well. The afternoon shift was considerably later. It was usually his secretary at the Canberra Times who would... it was 2:30 was the time for Jack then, and often Judy, who was his then secretary, would have to find him somewhere. Sometimes it was still in a restaurant having lunch. So the listeners at 3CR would have Jack Waterford having had, in some cases, quite a good lunch, but always making his brilliant and insightful comments. After a little while, Jack offered me a job here, so I came to Canberra. I'm a Melbourne person originally, and worked for him and with him for 7 years. One of the things I continued from my previous life was an interest in food. There are about 3 full-time jobs for food writers in Australia, we all know who's got them. Terry Durack, Jill Duplay, and sometimes John Lethian, and a couple of people from the Herald. So I started doing restaurant reviewing sort of on the side at the same time as being a serious journalist, and I was very excited to be a serious journalist. Very early on in my career, a very good woman journalist who taught me an enormous amount, Verona Burgess, who now works for the Financial Review, and you will have read as the public service reporter here in Canberra for a number of years, took me aside very discreetly and said, "Katrina, I just need this one thing I need to tell you. If you write food, you'll never be taken seriously as a journalist, so you need to think really hard about that." And I said, "Look, I'm afraid it's a no bargain with me. It's just, I know some people see it as just the cooking column, but there comes a point when your responsibility as a woman is to change those sorts of perceptions rather than say, oh, it's cooking column, oh, I mustn't do it because I won't be taken seriously." So it's things have changed so much now, and we are now so sodden in sometimes good, sometimes appalling food culture surrounding us on every piece of television, everywhere you go, that there's more, not always better, but more. Things have certainly changed since then. But I think, excuse me, my phone really should have been turned off, sorry, but that is extraordinarily rude. One of the things you never lose as a political staffer is you always have this. They're foul, absolutely foul things. One of the things I have tried to do is to continue with food writing and continue with it in an intelligent way. There hasn't always been enough time. There hasn't always been enough headspace to do it as well as I would like to do it. But it's one of the things that I will do to the day I die, because it's the thing that I find probably most fascinating. And it's always been on the side, because you simply can't earn a living, and probably it's not quite enough to fill up my head anyway. But it's something that I found absolutely fascinating all my life, and I think that My sister was with me last week. She knits. I cook. She knits. She's a filmmaker in Melbourne. Right? She was making a hat for my biggest daughter's 21st birthday. And she just said, it's the thing that keeps me calm. It's the thing that means when I'm with the kids or on the tram, there's something I'm constantly doing with my hands. It's not particularly intellectually challenging, but it requires serious concentration because, you know, you lose a stitch of hat it. And I think that really struck me because I think cooking and thinking about food and reading about food is the same thing for me. It's the thing that gives you a certain sort of balance among what can be, in career terms and everything else terms, quite a big, complex and multifaceted, you know, career and everything can sometimes be all-consuming, and I think it's enormously important, not particularly as a woman, just as a person, to have something that you find always interesting, always different, and can somehow give you some kind of internal satisfaction regardless of what else is going on. I could talk about food forever and I'd probably bore you absolutely to tears. You might like to know something a little more about the career. So I worked at the Canberra Times for 7 years and I learned an enormous amount about many things that are incredibly important. I learned how to spell. I was a terrible speller, absolutely terrible. The discipline of when I began at the Canberra Times, Jack consigned me, I still was consigned to the sub-editor's desk, to a man called Bill Goodall, who's now retired down to the coast. Bill taught me how to spell. He taught me how to write, not just well, because I could write well, but quickly and concisely, and he taught me how to write that magnificent thing, the headline, to take someone else's 2,000 words, make it into 1,100 words, and condense it into two or three words. That set of skills is a set of skills that I will take with me all my life, and I think if there's one thing that's terribly sad about the changes to newspapers at the moment is people are not getting those skills. There are virtually no sub-editors left in Australia. They're all either offshore or the job just isn't being done. Most people don't even know what a sub-editor is. One of my best friends, Margaret Simons, describes sub-editors as bitter old men who've failed in life. This is slightly unfair, I think, but sometimes when you meet them, you think, hang on a minute, maybe she's right. But pedants about language and grammar and getting it right. I mean, these things are actually enormously important. Newspapers are the modern, were to about a minute ago, the most important mode of democratic communication. They'll still be there, they'll be there in some form, but doing that democratic communication well, making it engaging, that's a really important thing to do. And being trained as a sub-editor makes you 100 times better at that. It also makes you a much better journalist. And understanding the full way a whole newspaper works, or a whole radio sort of the same, TV kind of a bit the same, understanding how the full thing is produced is enormously important, and that's stood me in good stead all my life. It means that when I have to write a restaurant review in an hour and a half, I can do it. Probably not quite as well as you might do it when you've got 3 hours, but it means that you can communicate quickly and concisely, and the lessons that I learned there, and you learn them pretty brutally. Things were much calmer by the time I got to the Canberra Times. Back in the old days, the chief sub-editor would stand, shout your surname, so if it was me, it'd be Jackson! You would be hauled in front of, it was then Michael Travers, quite a ferocious man, and your sin, your misspelling or your grammatical mistake would be broadcast across the entire newsroom. You would be utterly humiliated in front of all of your colleagues. I don't recommend this as a particularly good educational technique, but, well, I can spell now, so. after 7 years with the Canberra Times and an enormous amount of learning and an enormous amount of joy and pleasure in meeting people who I still know and still value enormously as friends, I decided to move into politics. This was a move that all of my journalistic colleagues were absolutely horrified by. Jack Waterford, in the farewell speech to me, was enormously polite for about a second, and then he turned to me and said, Katrina, this is the worst decision you will ever make. So with that set of good wishes, the reason I moved was the man I decided to work for, Kim Carr, I'd worked with quite closely, or I'd written many stories about. He did lots of work in the Senate estimates process under the John Faulkner mantra of bringing the government down via the Senate estimates process. If you don't know, Senate estimates is the time when the opposition can come and ask government a government and the bureaucracy any question they like. And if you've ever spent any time listening to estimates or reading the stories about estimates back in those days, Robert Ray and John Faulkner were absolutely magnificent at it. They were almost as good as journalists. They would come in and they would interrogate hour after hour after hour into issues like children overboard or things that clearly were not right and the public had clearly not been told the whole story on. So those sorts of things genuinely attracted me. Kim was a politician who genuinely cared about a particular portfolio. That was the portfolio I reported on, so science, so research and science, but higher education more broadly. He clearly had a genuine interest in how universities worked, how research institutions worked, and he pursued that through the Senate Estimates process. Senate Estimates research is a little bit like journalism, so it didn't seem, frankly, to me, that the jobs were all that different. It was, however, going to the dark side, according to absolutely everyone I knew, and people still speak to me now. But there were moments at which journalism is a very pure, was seen in some cases as a very pure form, and politics is very impure in some cases. The 5 years of opposition, I quite like opposition. I'm an unusual person. Most political staff don't like opposition because you can't really do much. You spend an awful lot of time talking about what you might like to do in government, but you can't actually really proactively do anything. I'm not quite sure why I didn't mind it. There's an awful lot to find out, and I like finding stuff out. To be brutally honest, it's also significantly more human in terms of the hours you work and your ability to lead your life. So through that four and a half years in opposition, I had both my children, and that was manageable through that period. My most recent child was born just before Kevin Rudd won the election, and I don't think any of us quite understood what that meant. At that period, there were hardly any staff working for the Labor government who'd worked for a Labor government in government before. Our induction session with Robert Ray made that very clear to us. He said, look, you guys, you haven't done this before. There are a couple of absolutely critical things you must remember. Number one, make sure you read a book. No matter what happens, no matter how busy you get, make sure you read a book every now and then, because if you don't, you'll just dry up. Number two, you must wash your own cups. If you do not wash, and this means from the minister, the department secretary, down. If you do not wash your own cups, if you don't maintain a civilised environment inside the office, things will completely fall apart. So I've taken those two things. I don't think I ever read the book. There was never time. I'm trying to do that at the same time as have your children and do your job properly. I didn't read for 2.5 years, and I just don't, that's not a way to live, as far as I'm concerned. But I did wash my cups, and the minister I worked for almost always washed his cups. And when he didn't wash his cups, he was reminded of the fact by all the staff, including the men on the staff and the women on the staff, that he hadn't washed his cups. And this is the wiggly edge. I'm not going to talk for too much longer. I'm really, really keen to have your questions. So get them ready, because I'll come and sit out there and I'll be unhappy if you don't ask some things. A couple of things I think worth mentioning. Just after we won government, sorry, I must stop saying we, just after the now current government won government, there was a women's function hosted by Tanya Plibersek, and she made mention of the fact that when there were then three women chiefs of staff in political offices under the Rudd government, and that was the first time there had ever been three chiefs of staff. Doesn't seem an enormously large number to me, but it was more than there had ever been. While I was there, there were a number of female senior staff. There were, however, when you count them, there were exactly two, including me, senior staff who had kids at the same time as being senior staff. So there was me, and I just had both my girls, so they were one and three, and Joe, who was Jenny Macklin's chief of staff. Doing that requires unbelievably significant management, and I don't think, I mean, if it was a perfect world and you could choose to do things slightly differently and time your children differently, then you would, but you just can't. So the way Jo dealt with it was that she went home for dinner between 5:30 and 7:00 to see the kids, put them to bed. That was the only time she saw her children during the day. She was out of the house before 6:00 and she had that hour and a half. That was how she managed it. It's absolutely brutal. I was the only woman who was in a senior position who insisted on leaving at 5:30 so I could pick up my children. You can imagine 5:30, I'm picking, they're the last kids at childcare. You only just get there to collect them. I thought, oh, if I start terribly early, I can fit everything in, I can feed them, put them to bed, and then I can work on it. Never works that way. So most of the time I would collect them with the phone in one hand and, you know, the computer on your knee, try and cook dinner at the same time, and wonder why. There was just never enough time. They would always, they always wanted more time, and entirely understandably, they are very small. In the end, I left 2.5 years into government. That was the reason I left. And people say, oh, Katrina, you had kids. It's entirely understandable. It wasn't just that I had kids. It was that there was absolutely no time for anything other than work. And having thought about it really hard and spoken to an enormously large number of my both current and former colleagues, that doesn't just affect you if you have children. That affects you no matter who you are. There were, as everyone knows, there are an enormously large number of young, quite senior, and in some cases too senior for their age staff while I was there. And there was a 29-year-old phenomenon. I would see those kids in the corridor. I shouldn't call them kids, but, you know, 29, for heaven's sake, they're kids. And I'd think, you're so young, you're okay. You just, you know, you have that ability to stay out all night and bounce back. After I left, there's something about leaving that means people are honest with you. Almost all of those kids who in some cases left after me or stayed would see me in the street or down at Tilly's or in the supermarket and they would rush up and they'd say, oh, Katrina, Katrina, I'm out. Are you okay? I think I'm all right. Many of them had, I mean, they had nervous breakdowns. They were 29. They are now 30 or 31. Most of them, and the vast majority, did not stay married if they were married, didn't keep their partner if they had one. There was, excuse me if I'm frank, there's no time for sex. There's no time for all those things that are part of a relationship that are absolutely critical. So people were, there was a morning, an early Monday morning when a chief of staff from, in fact, the other woman who was chief of staff for John Faulkner at the time, was in the lift at the same time as me at 6. It's a little bit late to get in as a Labor staffer, 6. She was carrying, Monday morning, carrying all her shopping. So that's breakfast, lunch and dinner all week in the office. Her clothes, she brought in on Tuesday. She went home to sleep, probably a little less than is a... so she would be having maybe 6, maybe 5 hours if she was extremely lucky. One of the best advisors in government who worked in Kevin Rudd's office and had worked for the Labor Party for probably 25 years, Jack Lake, is a cross-country runner. And towards the end, and just before he stopped working for Rudd, he said, Katrina, I'm doing my cross-country run at 3:30 in the morning because that's the only time I can do it because Rudd's office starts at 5:30. So, you know, you're there at 5:30 and you leave at midnight. So you can try and add up how many hours sleep that means or hours to do anything else. So all your clothes are dry cleaned because you can't possibly wash anything because it takes time. If you have children, you have to have a partner who looks after them almost all the time. I'm enormously lucky to have a husband who is enormously tolerant and who had children before, so knew what he was doing. But it puts an extraordinary quantity of pressure on both your relationship and just your ability to cope. I'm a hardworking, optimistic person, but to be brutally honest, I don't think it's viable. 2 weeks ago, that CV was quite funny. It just does highlight, doesn't it, that things change so unbelievably quickly. Week and a half ago, the old boss rang up and said, so you want to come back? And you didn't understand, did you? I am very fond of you, but I have done my stint. I have done my stint and there will be absolutely no coming back. Almost all the rest of his staff have gone back. There's something enormously alluring about politics. I don't quite understand it. There's something that some people simply cannot resist. Almost all of those people have gone back and suspended other careers, suspended other lives to have what might be a last dip, might not be a last dip, might turn into something further. But having spoken to them very briefly in the last couple of days, because even as very close friends, all you have time to do is talk very briefly to anyone you know or do anything outside the job. It's people who tell me things have changed are just absolutely kidding themselves. It's, you know, it's back to exactly the same routine. No sleep, constant adherence to the 24/7 news cycle. And these are not things, this is not a judgment on the man who happens to be in charge right now. This is a broader comment about how complex modern politics is. This is turning into a bit of a rant, isn't it? I'll get you to ask some questions which might focus me slightly in a moment. Thinking about how far women have come, I mean, all that Labor Party stuff doesn't bode particularly well, does it really? It always struck me as being relatively ironic that the Party of the Workers is not particularly good to its staff, both male and female, but I think that's probably politics. I don't think it makes any difference which side you're on. But thinking about how far women might have come in the recent past, I was in the one of the nice little ANU cafes near the Coombs building the other day, and behind me was Hilary Charlesworth. If you don't know Hilary Charlesworth or don't know of her, she's an extraordinary woman. She's one of the serious preeminent experts in international law, both in Australia but also internationally. She's also an extraordinarily modest and lovely woman. I mean, she would no more boast about herself than run around naked. She's an extraordinary woman. Her parents grew up with my parents in Melbourne, so I know her very faintly. And she was behind me at the queue, and I thought, goodness me, she won't even remember who I am. But I turned around and said hello, and she said, "Oh, Katrina, of course I remember." We had a bit of a chat about, you know, general family catch-up stuff, and she said, "Now, Katrina, I will never forget a column you wrote probably 15 years ago about cream caramel." I thought, oh, goodness me. You know, so at that time I was the education reporter, you know, I thought it might have been expose of the internal politics of, you know, constant reviewing at the ANU, or it might have been, you know, the latest scoop on Brendan Nelson's education package or something, but no, the creme brulee recipe. It wasn't my recipe. It was the fact that I described it as a recipe from my father, excuse me, who's a philosopher at the ANU. His name's Frank Jackson. Hillary's father was a philosopher in Melbourne, Max Charlesworth, and she said, Katrina, she'd made the recipe and it worked. So she was doubly astonished. She said, look, it's not, it wasn't, I'm sorry, Katrina, it wasn't the recipe. It was the fact that your father, a really very good philosopher, can make dessert, can make a cream caramel. Now, I found this a really lovely story, and it said a fair bit about Hillary as much as anything else, and male philosophers, to be completely honest. But I just thought, my father's a very intelligent man. Why shouldn't he be able to make a cream caramel? You know, a classic dessert. It's not that difficult, to be brutally honest. But my grandfather, who was also a philosopher, could make coffee and could boil eggs. My father couldn't cook at all when Mum and Dad got married. Mum taught him to cook, and he's now an extremely good cook and takes genuine pride in it. But Mum spends her... I mean, back in the early days, people were astonished that Dad could cook, and it was honestly an extraordinary amount of dinner party chatter about the fact that Dad could cook. It still attracts comment. He's a very intelligent man. Why shouldn't he be able to get a bowl of spaghetti together for the kids? I mean, it's just, it does make you think. I quite often from, in many cases, my husband's football playing friends say, oh, Katrina, you know, all that feminism stuff sort of sorted out, isn't it? Everything's pretty equal now. You know, there's not much more sort of struggle to go on. You're just sort of going on a bit, aren't you? Excuse me. It still attracts comments that my dad can make a cream caramel. There's an awful lot further to go. I know the ability to make dessert is not a sign of, you know, gender equity, but when it doesn't attract comment that blokes can make dessert, can you make a cream caramel? Yes. Of course. See? Things are changing up the back here. I think that will be an extremely good sign when, you know, men can make cream caramel or something, or, you know, carry out basic domestic chores in a, you know, in a basically competent manner. I think probably this is the point at which I should ask you for some questions. I mean, I know Canberra's one of these wonderful places where there are probably 30 or 40 or probably every single person in the audience that has a story just as interesting as mine, possibly more interesting than mine, and will certainly have some interesting questions to ask. So I'm going to get away from here and come over here. And this amazing thing means I can do that and you can still hear me. How distressing that is. So who's going to be first? Here he comes.
I'd like to hear how you got from a food journalist, political journalist, to be CEO of the Science Peak Body.
Oh, indeed. Sorry, I probably should have actually gone to that. When I left the ANU, oh, look, to be completely honest, advocacy and lobbying is not the same as journalism, but it's not actually that far. I mean, what it requires is the ability to run a good argument. It requires a knowledge of politics and government and how those systems work. And it requires a sort of series of networks across a number of groupings, and they're three things that I've got. So, I mean, what we do at Science and Technology Australia, the title sounds unbelievably grand. We're quite a small organisation. I would like us to be a less small organisation, to be completely honest, and one of my jobs is to make us a bit bigger and to get some better resourcing. But most lobby groups actually aren't that big. The only ones that are really big are the ones that are attached to really major corporations. So the lobby group for, you know, the mining and minerals industry is quite well-resourced, as you might imagine. The reason it's important to, number one, have a peak group and have it do not just lobbying but also advocacy as well is because I think you probably can't pick two more different groups than politicians and scientists. They just operate on completely different thought processes, timelines. They're really unbelievably different creatures. If politicians don't understand what it is that people do, they don't know how to value that, and you simply don't get enough resourcing for it. So it's a constant battle to make sure that scientists are in the political and public mind, because it's terribly important the public understand as well, because the public vote in the politicians. So that's my job. My job is to keep science in the political mind, and because I come from both journalism and politics, I suppose that's what makes me appropriate for that particular position. I'm just going to move back slightly. Does that answer the question, at least partially?
Katrina, my question is about the recent leadership spill. Mm. You've obviously had wide experience as a journalist and as a political journalist. To what extent do you think the media was in part responsible for that? And if you don't think that, what do you think the reasons were for Julia losing the leadership?
Yeah. Gee, I don't know about the rest of you. I found that whole process unbelievably upsetting. I mean, I've worked in politics for a long time, so you try and not be upset. You try and sort of step back. But I just found that whole process, I found for that couple of weeks period, frankly, I was a bad-tempered cow. I found that extraordinarily upsetting. And I think I think blaming the media in this particular case, blaming the media is always a bit silly, but I think it's quite clear there was significant internal agitation from the moment Kevin Rudd lost the leadership. And whatever you think about that, it's quite clear that was going on in a sort of subterranean way. I think it becomes very difficult for press, especially press gallery journalists who are so sort of immersed in it, when there's something that's just chipping away underneath absolutely continually. They sort of have to report on it, but you do. I mean, like everyone else, you open those and think, oh, for God's sake, get onto something else. You know, I don't want to hear, you know, the tiny minutiae about who might be manoeuvring where, but then it actually happens. So I think there's an awful lot for all of us to think about in the reasons she was deposed and the way she was and why it is that she was so extraordinarily disliked. I mean, not just disliked, hated. My uncle is a very mild-mannered man. He called her a bitch at dinner at my parents' house about maybe a year and a half ago. I don't think my Uncle Johnny has ever called anyone a bitch in his life. But he heard what the people on the radio had said. He's not particularly well-educated. He picked it up. And I think he reflected what was the view among many people in Australia, not just men, and not just men, you know, many women as well. I found her last... Look, I'm sure you all watched that last speech and that part in which she talked about whether it was a woman thing or not a woman thing. I think that was a pretty good point, and I have an incredible quantity of admiration for her. I make no judgment on the policy content or how she ran the government. I think there are a whole broad range of other things to discuss there. But as a person, I'm not quite sure how it is you get up every day knowing that most of the nation, or a very large amount of the nation, hates your guts. I mean, not just dislikes you, not just thinks they might vote for someone else, but viscerally hates you. I mean, really, you know, thinks that there is something evil about you. I mean, what other Prime Minister in the country would it be tolerated for there to be banners with, you know, Ditch the Witch on them, or something equally insulting to a male? So not only does she put up with that, but she puts up with that. Finally, she does get deposed. Then she has the farewell thing at the lodge, which got, you know, reported by Tony Wright as, you know, a big knees up. Fun. The party after you get trounced. But she stands up, and as we've probably all read in the press, but as I've read in the press, but also I understand genuinely was the case, she stands up in front of all of those people, her supporters, and says, yes, we are upset. This is distressing, but what you mustn't do is you mustn't undermine the party. You must continue to work for the victory of the Labor government and the cause and all those things that all those people in that room, as in the lodge then, all those things that we all believe in. Don't let your personal upset and entirely justifiable, you know, crossness at what's just happened now poison what you might do in terms of the movement. I mean, obviously, you've got to make a decision about whether you want to be attached to a movement that does that. But that's not really an answer, is it? I think the media played a part, but I think it's almost impossible to discuss the media and this particular set of political machinations as separate things, because there are some journalists who are so seriously entwined in the process. I mean, I'm not sure how closely everyone followed the events, but these days, the way social media works is you log on to the four or five journalists who tweet all the time, or, you know, tweet or twat or tweet or whatever you want to call it, but the people who, you know, every second they're putting out what's happened that second. So if you want to know what's happening that second, you log on to three or four people who you know are absolutely across what is happening that second. So, I mean, literally, I mean, the old days, as a newspaper journalist, you would have your four or five sources, you'd be on the phone to them a lot, but you'd distill that, and the next day there would be a balanced account of what had happened. These days, say, Simon Benson, who's probably the best-connected political journalist, it works for Murdoch in this country, is getting, every single time he gets a call, he's tweeting the content of the call. So you can follow it that closely. But, I mean, that level of micro, out there in the public display of the internals of what's going on and everyone trying to influence what's going on. So, you know, all of Simon's contacts are trying to influence what's going on, and Shorten's people are ringing, and it's just absolute chaos. But those things are now so intertwined that it's actually really hard to answer that question, whether it's, you know, the media's fault or so-and-so's fault, because they're all in it together. That's a terribly cheap way of putting it, but they are. So, yes.
Two aspects to this question. First, do you think politics can be made less brutal? And the second question is, how much does the leader of the party in government or in opposition have to do with that? How much bearing do they give on the brutality of the whole process?
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm going to walk over and get my water. Sorry, it's incredible freedom having this thing attached. I can speak and get the water at the same time. Gee, well, you know, I hope it gets less brutal than it's been in the last couple of months, because it's pretty unattractive, isn't it? I mean, I always made sure when I was in politics that I would frequently ring my sister, who is not particularly political and doesn't live here, to just as a little bit of a reality check for what's going on in the rest of the world, and to try and pull yourself out of that little tiny sort of vortex you get sucked into. I'm not quite sure how it is you make it less brutal. I mean, I think some internal party reform in the Labor Party is absolutely critical to just the machinery stuff. In a sense, it swings. I mean, sometimes people want it to be less brutal. Sometimes people want it to be brutal but more entertainingly brutal. I think there's a fair bit of affection for Paul Keating in a sort of nostalgic way. I mean, he was a very brutal man, but more entertainingly brutal perhaps than people are now. I mean, Kevin Rudd's just not as, you know, good a wordsmith. I hope there'll be a point at which politics is slightly less brutal. I mean, it's fundamentally, it's a battle between two forces, and there is still a fairly strong commitment to ideology in a slightly weird and warped and slightly less understandable sense than there used to be. So you're always going to have a fairly vigorous fight. But I must say, I do miss the days in which politicians would go, you know, behind the speaker's box and have a good chat. And I miss people like John Button, but, you know, maybe that just shows my age. and people who genuinely had civilised relationships with other people, with people on the other side. At the same time, apparently Christopher Pyne and Anthony Albanese have a quite civilised relationship, so there may be a lot of brutality in the front, but in the back there's sort of a congenial sense. I think your point about the influence of a leader is absolutely critical. The behaviour of a leader makes an enormous difference to the way the party behaves, probably the least important, but then how the sort of body politic is, and I think decent behaviour from the leader is absolutely critical. And I think we've seen a lot of examples from both sides of politics in the recent past of, I wouldn't call it leadership, I'd call it, you know, leading through sort of fear-mongering. I mean, appealing to, and I really mean Labor at the same time as the Liberals here too, and while I worked for them, appealing to the least generous parts of people's instincts and getting some sort of short-term political capital out of that. That's a pretty bad way of running things. And it's also, it's lazy and it's cowardly, and it leaves you in a very bad position in the long run. And that's how New South Wales has been run for quite some time. And, gee, haven't they turned out well? Sorry, that's not a very good answer. Yes, sir.
Following on from that, just is there any way we can look at the other question that you raised of the so-called work-life balance? I've experienced that myself, worked in the public service for a while, and I could see that it just trickles down through the public service of people having to work long hours to meet critical deadlines and so on. Is there any way that culture can be improved?
Well, I think the leadership question there is absolutely critical. The very first the first month of the Rudd government, one of the then Prime Minister's, sorry, the Prime Minister, I'll have to get my lingo up to date, one of his staff members pointed out that he hadn't spoken to his staff yet. Not just his staff in his office, but he hadn't spoken to the broad spread of Labor staff. So we all gathered together in the courtyard of the staff cafeteria. So it's quite a big courtyard, but quite a few staff. So maybe there were 120, 130 of us. Rudd stood up on a chair and said, you know, welcome all. I'm sorry I haven't spoken to you yet. If you think this is hard, get used to it. There'll be more of the same. And that was the day we all became aware that there was a 30% cut in staff from the very start of government. So that was a political decision to make it seem like he was being more lean. But I think that the example set by the Prime Minister is enormously important. I mean, if basically it's just a work longer than anyone else and that's how you win example, I'm not quite sure how the public service is meant to cope. One of the genuine challenges for a staff member in a ministerial office is how you deal with the demands you're getting, the political demands you're getting from both your boss, but also if you work for a cabinet minister from a number of other offices, including the Prime Minister's office, how you deal with that and treat the public service decently. And I know, no matter how hard we tried in Carr's office, sometimes we didn't treat the public service decently, and there were a number of times at which really unreasonable demands were made. And there was also a continual level of pressure, which they felt just like we felt. And I think the less experienced staff are, the worse that transfer is. I mean, you could hear, I mean, you'd often, I was a press secretary for Karam Start, you get phone calls from the Prime Minister's office at, say, 5 in the morning, and it'd be from a kid, and you could hear the fear in their voice. They'd been shouted at either by the Prime Minister or the Chief of Staff or someone else to get something done, and they were just whooping it down the line. It was just anyone else they could sort of spread the pressure out to. And I know that spreads straight from the political sphere to the APS. And I think it ends up meaning that there is a feeling of, I mean, number one, people just get terribly overworked and don't sleep enough and don't see their families. And that's not a way to live. But I think it also means people get a terrible feeling of chasing a tail and doing a whole lot of work that is not always absolutely necessary. I mean, everyone's heard all the stories and read about all the stories about, you know, policy briefs being required at no notice and then being sort of forgotten. I mean, just that level of sort of freneticness has a terrible sort of vortex effect. I think the only way really to fix that is leadership from the top, both inside the public service but also politically, and I can't quite see a mechanism for doing that at the moment, apart from... If anyone's got any ideas, gratefully received. I think the people at the top really seriously have to set an example. Little tiny mini example with me. When I left politics and went to work for Ian Chubb, was then the Vice-Chancellor at ANU, there was a fairly significant, vigorous work ethic in the Chancellery at the ANU as well, which is fine. I'm very up for lots of hard work. But there was a little bit of spin, work for its own sake, person here longest, you know, gets the most kind of brownie points thing. And one of the things I did within the area that I ran was I made people go home. I lobbied very hard for additional staff in areas in which you really needed additional staff capacity. When people were sick, I sent them home. And I said, look, you know, this is ridiculous. This is you are genuinely ill. To be brutally honest, you're about to make everyone else in the office genuinely ill as well. Go home. Or if you have serious family responsibilities, that doesn't just mean children. That means family responsibilities. They take time and they are taken into account in the little small working unit. So I don't know. I mean, all those who've gone through the experience, I hope, go out and try and run a slightly more humane workplace when they have the responsibility for leadership, even if it's at a small level. There are some very good people in the public service who are very good on this, and under a slightly different kind of political leadership, maybe that would be let fly a bit. I don't know that it's a gender question. I don't know that a woman running things would make any difference to that, to be completely honest, because politics is so set and so hard to shift.
Is yes.
One of the things that is really hard to judge, I was talking to Jamie Button a while ago before he wrote his very nice book about what's happened in the Labor Party in the last couple of years, is when you're a staffer in a particular government, it's very hard to work out whether you're just weak and hopeless or whether everyone else had the same hard time or whether your government is worse. And I have a lot of friends who worked for at least the Howard government previously. It's quite hard to get a straight answer out of them, especially when you're actually in government, because, again, it's always a combative thing. It seems to me things are a little intensified under Rudd, but I don't know it's that different, to be completely honest. I think the 30% staff cut at the very start did make a genuine difference, because once you've made a staff cut, you can't put it back. Well, I mean, maybe you can by sort of stealth, but sneaking some extra people in without saying anything. But it's like, you know, you take a pay cut, you can't put it back politically. What I understand of the way Gillard worked things was there was a little more humanity in the hours. She sleeps a little bit more than Rudd does. I mean, I think some people just need less sleep. I don't know if anyone else watched that that very interesting English sort of doctor guy who did the thing on sleep the other day. Sleep's a very mysterious thing. Some people genuinely need 8 hours. Some people can get by on, you know, 3 or 4. But I do think it's a little bit of a myth that you don't need too much. I mean, Rudd's bad-tempered, frankly. And part of the reason he's bad-tempered, he doesn't get enough sleep. It's quite simple, to be completely honest. So, you know, I think there's a macho kind of, oh, I can do it thing. But I'm afraid I haven't got an absolutely concrete answer about whether things really were genuinely different under that particular administration, because it's always really intense, but I think the media cycle speed up has made things more intense. And when I talked before about the constant pressure, that constant feeling of I'll tell you one story. We were on the way back from one of the very few weekends we got down to the coast during the period when I was working for the government. I was toilet training my smallest Stella. So we're in the toilet at the Batemans Bay, you know, the bakery that everyone stops at. We're in the toilet. I am holding her over the toilet. She's, you know, about one and a bit. So, you know, I'm actually holding her up over the toilet. My phone rings and my husband answers the phone. It's the Prime Minister's press secretary. Andrew, my husband, was in the press gallery at that point. So he knew the person on the phone. He said, look, Lockie, she's holding Stella over the toilet. Can she ring you back in 2 minutes? The child is literally suspended over the toilet. Can you just hang on? He screamed down the phone, I cannot get her on the phone this very second. So I put Stella down onto the toilet. I took the telephone call. Andrew came in, picked up the baby. That's not because the person on the other end of the telephone is an absolute beast. That's because he has even less sleep than I have. There is a constant level of expectation that you will be near a phone, able not just to take a phone call and make an intelligent response to a phone call, but then write a brief inside 3/4 of an hour at all hours of the day or night, every day of the week, every single day of the week. So that level of pressure was felt by every single staff member, and the staff members who didn't feel quite that much pressure, I don't know how they did it. And in most cases, they actually did. They were just better at lying than me. That's a circular answer, but that sort of thing that particular circumstance stays with me, because that person was not a beast, but you could hear the I have to deliver somehow, so I will be unbelievably unreasonable in relation to someone I know, you know, who's a journalist who might even report on this, actually, to be brutally honest. I mean, you know, press secretary screaming at bureau chief in press gallery, interesting story, but, you know, but luckily my husband didn't report some things because he knew I would get sacked or would get shouted at even more by the Prime Minister's office. Sorry, half an answer, maybe.
Your science and technology, how can we actually improve that? I mean, what strategies are being used and what might be used? Because we're not all football followers.
Yes.
We don't all have... anyway, I won't say the rest.
You mean in terms of recognition among politicians or...? Absolutely. Absolutely.
We don't know whether we are now because we don't hear about anything.
Yeah. There was a... the ANU did an ANU poll about maybe 2 years ago about sort of the awareness of science in the public mind. And one of the really interesting results of that survey was people are actually more interested in hearing about science stories than they are about sport, which surprised me, I've got to say.
Why don't you hear it?
Well, indeed. And why isn't there, you know, a 5 minutes science cast at the end of every news bulletin. If you actually have a really good look at media and survey the amount of science, it's actually quite a bit. It's not always quite as prominent, and it's not always as mainstream. So if you go to the ABC Science page, it's chock-a-block full of unbelievably interesting stories. And I think people have a genuine interest in science, but usually a particular kind of science. And, you know, a whiz-bang discovery, etc. And I think it's entirely fair to say that in the last couple of years, the intrusion of politics into science has been a really serious problem. I mean, the climate science staff has left science in a highly politicised space. And for heaven's sake, the last place you want to be is in the middle of a political debate, because it's just, frankly, you can't win. I mean, I think it's entirely fair to say that we lost the climate science debate. And we lost the climate science debate because we're up against extraordinarily well-armed forces, but also because it became political. And scientists just aren't equipped, no matter what you do. I mean, this was happening right in the middle of the period that I was running the communications effort at the ANU. So we spent an enormous amount of time with people like Will Steffen and Andrew McIntosh and, in some cases, Ross Garnaut and Frank Giozzo and people who have enormously intelligent things to say about climate science. We media trained them within an inch of their lives. We armed them with everything. Will did an absolutely magnificent interview with Alan Jones. He went up to Sydney. He went up to Sydney, so he was in the studio. He spent 3/4 of an hour live on the program. He took half an hour of talkback. At the end of it, he actually did a magnificent job. Will is an unbelievably calm character. He also takes advice about how to deal with people like Jones, and we'd prepped him within an inch of his life. I mean, hours and hours of prep. We'd listened to Jones for weeks beforehand, looking at exactly what angles he was going to take, told Will so that he'd know. We rehearsed stuff with him, and he's an absolutely extraordinary performer. So you can take them individually like that, and on that day I thought, that's a win. There were people who've gone away from that program having heard Will and having heard Jones, and by the end of it, because Will just did not take the bait, did not rise, did not lose his temper, did not become irrational at any point, did not get cross at any point, despite Alan Jones's continual attempts to make him really cross. At the end of it, well, he walked into the studio, he sat down, Alan Jones said, "You haven't bothered to shave, Professor." And Will said, "He's got a beard. It's a beard. It's quite clearly a beard. So what do you say?" I mean, Jones just tries. I mean, he's an extraordinary character. He's unbelievably able to make people cross from the second they walk in. But so you can attack things those ways. So at the end of that, Will sounded reasonable and Jones sounded manic. So I think there will be some listeners to that program who might have thought perhaps, well, hang on a minute, he sounds like quite a reasonable guy. I wouldn't mind having him round to my place for tea or having, you know, a muffin with him or something. Jones sounded a bit off the beam. But in a broad sense, I think we genuinely lost that debate because we tried to fight it on the terms that academics will always try and fight things with the evidence. And the forces well lined up against us were not doing the evidence. I mean, you go to see anything that Lord Monckton does and the man is apart from being a complete charlatan, but he's a showman, not a... And that's unbelievably difficult to deal with. And because that's now seriously penetrated politics, and you go and talk to coalition politicians, including Sophie Mirabella, who is the Shadow Minister for Science, who, as is likely the coalition will win, will likely be the Minister for Science. She thinks that scientists have become political. I'm using her words exactly. This is something we absolutely have to cope with because she thinks that it's science's fault that that's happened. I'm not giving you any answers. All I'm doing is making the problems sound bigger. I think it's incredibly important to understand the nature of those problems before we can actually try and tackle them. So what we do at Science and Technology to try and get around those things is we do a whole bunch of stuff that is really just about getting politics and science a bit closer together. So we do Science Meets Parliament. So we take 200-odd scientists up to Parliament House for a couple of days. We give them a bit of training about how to talk to politicians. Then we match them up with politicians with similar interests and they all go and have one-on-one meetings. That then leads to, in about half the cases, a sort of developing relationship, sometimes with a minister, but sometimes with a backbencher or your local member, where the scientists then keep in contact with a local member, tell them about their research, invite them out to their facility in some cases, and you get quite fruitful little relationships growing up. And I think it's a question of understanding what the interests of each one is. Scientists understanding that politicians are interested in things that affect their electorate, things that the voters are concerned with. They don't always all have a bucket of money at their left-hand side to grab, and that we as scientists have to demonstrate in every single time. I know it's tedious, but we have to do it. You have to demonstrate the worth of what you're doing, because if you don't, politicians just don't get it. They won't go into cabinet and argue for it. They should, but they just won't. So you have to present why it is that it's valuable again and again and again and again and again. And that's my job. So, dull, but you got to do it. Yes?
Does research get a lesser budget allocation because of that need to prove to the politician that whatever the scientist is bringing up is relevant to their electorate, and research doesn't necessarily immediately state that or show that?
Certainly, there's a common sort of common mantra that, you know, there's no votes in research. I think it's our job to work as hard as we possibly can to change that, because if you just use the word research and treat it as sort of a great big theoretical thing, it's pretty easy to discount because politicians can't see an immediate benefit. But if you discuss the fruits of research, so you know, you talk about Carl Wood being responsible for IVF, or John Sullivan inventing Wyland. So, you know, so everything that the reason I can talk through this, the reason my phone works, the reason the iPad works, all those sorts of things, politicians understand that. You just got to put it in concrete terms. The problem at the moment is that the political cycle seems to be getting a bit shorter. And I don't want to sound like a person who just is thinking everything was better before and is worse now, because it's terribly easy to slip into that, but I think it is getting a little bit shorter, and I think the challenge for us is to communicate the long-term benefits and convince politicians that those long-term benefits are about leadership and vision. there about things that they really can genuinely grab onto and they can use electorally and they can use as the point you made before, as a marker of leadership, and it's enormously important. It doesn't have to be just a, this is in your pocket this second, because we all know, all the surveys tell us that people do respond to things that are about the amount of money they've got in their pocket, but they also genuinely respond to things that they think that are really in the interests of both their kids and the future of the nation. You've just got to explain it clearly enough. Research never gets enough money, and it'll be hard to... I mean, we won't turn into a country like Germany anytime soon, I don't think. It's just, and I don't quite know why, but it's a slightly different culture, which is a shame. We don't have nearly enough respect for, say, people in the university just up the road up there. I mean, people who should be, you know, heroes. People don't even know who they are. It's a funny country, Australia. But yes, is the answer to your question, and hoping we can do something about it is the second bit of the answer to your question. Yes? I think fixed terms would be a lot better. Yeah, I think there are lots of arguments backwards and forwards, but I think it'd do two things. I think it'd remove the politics out of the timing of the election, and just that sucks up so much, you know, organisational and emotional energy. And 4 years is a bit longer than three, isn't it? So it's still not a very long time, but I don't think you want to go to five, to be completely honest, because I think I want to have the option to say what I think about who should be running the country every 4 years. Maybe every five's a little bit too long. But, I think certainly that would be a... No. No. And frankly, four's not really enough time to do anything either, but it's better than three. So, yes. Yes. Indeed.
But I'm just wondering, my opinion is that if you can read, you can cook. And this week's episode demonstrated that beautifully. The person concerned could read, so he could actually work the recipe. He didn't actually do it very well. But what is your opinion on that sort of use of the media to get... they're obviously doing the right thing and showing all their right things, but occasionally they let slip.
I think that program is fantastic. I think Annabel Crabb's done unbelievably well to get politicians to agree to do it in the first place. I understand it takes 6 hours to film every time. So that's a very significant commitment of time. And you do just get a bit of an idea of what sort of person they are. I mean, what do we have? Malcolm Turnbull pulling yabbies out of his own little dam. How unbelievably... And what a great attempt to be seen as a man of the people while being not a man of the people at all. It's his dam, for heaven's sake. He probably had them put there. But he clearly could cook a bit, couldn't he? You know, and the spectacle of Nick Xenophon clearly being slightly defensive and a bit neurotic about...
Can't come to
his house, making a stupidly over-providing and then doing the breaking the plates thing in a slightly kind of, is it a good idea? Is it not a good idea? And the Bromma Bishop episode? Was there a speck of dust anywhere in her perfect apartment? I think we probably all learn more about politicians through that program than we do through almost anything else. Maybe Q&A, if you can bear watching it. But I think we probably learn more through that. And that's the power of food is... I know a half about food, but I think it's an enormously powerful medium because we all have... It's not... When I say I cook, my sister knits, you have to cook. Everyone has to do it at some point or somehow engage with it. And it has an incredible quantity of cultural power. So Xenophon is obviously showing us his heritage by showing us the fantastic Greek stuff with seven times more garlic in the dip than is meant to be. And, you know, the brilliant... If you didn't see it, he had two octopus, full-size octopus, which he took over to the souvlaki shop over the road and splayed on the grill. I mean, these were huge beasts. They were just fantastic. It was sort of a magnificent display of... Not quite macho, but I'll think of a better word later for that. But it was absolutely brilliant stuff. But you do get a magnificent insight. And I think food is one of those things that brings everyone down to a... or down, up, or wherever, brings them to a particular level. And it's... I think it's a brilliant show. I mean, sometimes more insights than others. I thought the Peter Garrett one was really nice too, because you get a sense of the fact that he's from quite a conservative background... quite a staid man himself, which seems extraordinary given he was the, you know, the lead singer for a serious Australian rock band. But you get insights into, well, his dad was a Presbyterian minister, I think. His mother was killed in a house fire when he was quite young, and he ran in to try and save her and failed to save her. And I think that's one of the things that's really marked his life. You don't get these insights through many other media. And also, being someone who's spent a lot of time with press gallery journalists, you hear lots of nice little personal stories, but Annabelle manages to get them out through that program, and you're right. They do occasionally let slip, but you don't get the sort of Maxine McHugh kind of interview, you know, goodness me, a great big revelation. You get a sense of what sort of people they are as human beings, and that kind of understanding is enormously important because they're not all beasts. I mean, frankly, some of them are. Let's be brutal. But they're interesting beasts, usually. I think that kind of understanding is enormously important, because if we don't make any effort to understand them, then, you know, the more understanding, the better. So, yes, and that's the only program that I'll actually change arrangements to actually try and see. Anyone else? Goodness me, you're telling me that everything the media shows is not entirely true? Lordy, lordy, could you radical? Take that man out the back. I think there's always been a bit of nip and tuck when it comes to various things, but I think things are getting a bit worse, and I think at the moment they're a bit worse because there's just... I think it's important to understand that the nature of the revolution in print, I think, more than television and radio, but there's an enormous amount of flow through. But just the revolution in what's going on at the moment. I mean, the business model of print media is completely broken. I was in the press gallery the other day, and I think there are half as many journalists as there were last time I was there. And maybe that was up there for a sustained period over the last 3 months. I mean, my husband was a journalist from the age of 17 until 4 years ago, in which he transferred to being a lawyer. Virtually all of our friends are journalists. Every single time they see Andrew, the first thing they say is, okay, so how long did the degree take? How do I get out? What do I do? These are people who all they want to be is be a journalist, and in most cases they are very, very, very good at it. But there is just not a job. So it sounds like I'm making excuses. I think that the people who used to pay attention to that sort of stuff, that's your sub-editor. That's the television version of a sub-editor. So, I mean, when I first started in print journalism under Jack and under Bill Goodall, making a mistake like that would have been a hanging offence. My very first terrible mistake was in, I think it might even have been one of the public sector magazines in the Canberra Times. I managed to put a picture of Mr Menzies and a picture of a snowman next to each other, and I managed to transfer the captions. So, yeah. I was in seriously big trouble, but I was actually seriously hauled over the coals for that mistake, and that's a relatively simple mistake to make these days. All of my job was laying out that magazine for that day and getting the pictures all right. I didn't have to write, you check the headlines and stuff, but so there was, and there were probably 30 sub-editors from the Canberra Times in those days. I don't think there are 10 left these days. They won't quite tell me where the sub-editing is being done. I suspect some of it's being done offshore. I suspect some of it's not being done at all. There are people who edit sections of the Canberra Times. Sorry, my knowledge is best of the Canberra Times at this stage. Some of the section editors are doing all the subbing themselves. That means there's no one else casting an eye over. So the golden rule used to be, I'm sure as many of you know, that the person who writes it, puts it into the basket, it then gets copy-tasted, so to speak, by the next person down the line to check that it's all okay and it's okay to go into the process. It then gets properly sub-edited by a person to make it right to length and to fix the grammar and to check all the facts. It then gets put on the page by someone separate, and pictures and headline and stuff are all arranged and advised by that person. It will then be proofread on hard copy in detail after that. That process is not, that's not like that anymore. It's, they've just cut a whole bunch of steps out of the process. And that process is the only thing that means that things don't stuff up. I love sub-editors because as a reporter, you'd write your stuff and you felt secure. that someone who had more time and, in many cases, frankly, more knowledge than you was reading every single word very, very carefully. I don't have that level of security anymore at all. Yeah.
I have a bit of trouble accepting your line.
Yeah.
If it was once when I saw a terrible compensation coming out of it...
Yeah. Yep.
It's not once, it's every time I turn on ABC News, they're discussing that. So it's not sub-editor's error, it's something else to do with, I think, culture, trying to con us.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I come from.
I think it's a dumbing down.
I think it's a dumbing down.
It's a dumbing down. It's so confusing. Yeah. What happens today, no one cares about tomorrow, it's all changed. So it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. Maybe see so you reckon it's more a conspiracy theory than a inadvertence?
Conspiracy theories, but I think it's a cultural thing, yeah. And I don't find scientists who do have the opportunity, I mean I've lived near them, I talk to them, they're not saying what a friend of mine just said. They're actually just sort of keeping quiet and letting it go.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, look, you know, and a couple of letters to the editor or to the ABC, but that would probably be very well placed. I'm sure they have. Yeah. Look, I'm not quite sure what the answer is there.
On a film, to look at all this condensation coming out, and if you do look at these stats, there's very little to see.
Doesn't look as good?
That's precisely right. So what looks good ends up being...
Maybe.
Hi, guys. We are so running out of time. And I reckon everyone is... probably dying to get a snack downstairs in the Friends Lounge. Mm. Can you please thank Katrina Jackson? This has been a fantastic talk, and I think the most questions that we've ever had from one of our...
Thank you very much.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.